We, the fans of Star Wars, do this day send forth this declaration to the president of Lucasfilm, Kathleen Kennedy, and to all the people in the world to make clear to all the purposes and goals of this rebellion. We firmly acknowledge the importance and necessity of the control of the franchise being in the hands of one person. We accept that for a contiguous, non-contradictory continuity to be established, much of the old must be done away with to make way for the new, so that we can enjoy the universe without questioning how something makes sense. We believe that those in charge of a franchise derives its power as a creative force from the consent of the fandom of the franchise, of that franchise. We believe that, should fans, lifelong fans especially, be purposefully shunned, insulted, and tossed aside by those at the head of the franchise, it is the inalienable right of the fans to boycott or force change in such leadership.
We believe that Lucasfilm has willfully and malignantly discarded the fans in the sole pursuit of misguided political causes. And when those helming a franchise display a history of callous disrespect for said franchise, its long-storied history and its massive fan base, displaying a clear design to subjugate totally and absolutely the characters we have come to know and love solely to push a social narrative, it is our right, our duty, to depose that leadership. The short history of the current leadership of Lucasfilm is that of continued grievous offenses and insults against consumers who have been fans of the franchise for any period of time before it was purchased by Disney.
You have disrespected the characters of the original trilogy, treating them as mere tools and stepping stones for new characters, rather than the heroes they actually are. You have used your new characters as toys and tools to push an agenda of masculine inferiority. You have lied to George Lucas when you told him that legacy characters would be protected and make sure they would continue to live in that way that he had created them. You have lied to George Lucas when you said you wanted to do something for the fans, and now have fully reneged on that promise, telling Mark Hamill that the stories you want to tell matter more than the fans. You have given the core trinity of characters from the original trilogy terrible send-offs. Luke Skywalker dying as a sour old man who couldn't be bothered to come help his sister in person or mourn the loss of his best friend. Han Solo dying by the blade of his own son in a move that ultimately had zero impact on his psychological state moving forwards. Leia flying back to the Raddus in a comedic scene that reminds one of Mary Poppins and will shamefully forever be how Carrie Fisher's last outing in film will be remembered. You have shamelessly attacked anyone who voiced a negative opinion, calling them racist, sexist, misogynist, telling them that they must have a problem with strong women, telling them that only overweight white males and members of the alt-right dislike the direction you are taking the franchise. You have refused to acknowledge any complaints as legitimate from the fans, and do not even recognize that people who are not male or are not Caucasian dislike your modus operandi as well.
We, the fans of Star Wars, do therefore in the name and by the authority of the free market of the world, solemnly publish and declare our intentions
to fight and oppose you and your socio-political ideals by any means at our disposal.
To refuse any decree from Lucasfilm as to what we should like that is contrary to the right of opinion.
To bring about your destruction and the destruction of your career in anything relating to filmography.
To forever restore the true characterization of these beings in a galaxy far, far away.
To these ends, we pledge our merchandise, our honor, and our wallets.
Icky girls, give us back our Star Wars.
This is not a drill, people. This shit is real.
Welcome to the Everyone's a Critic Movie Review Podcast. I'm your co-host, Bob Zarrell.
Hey, I met you. You are not cool.
With me, as always, is professional film critic Sean Patrick.
I am the smart. S-M-R-T. I mean S-M-A-R-R-T.
And Josh Adams.
You goddamn communist heathen, you had best sound off that you love the Virgin Mary, or I'm going to stomp your guts out. Now, you do love the Virgin Mary, don't you?
Visit us at IHateCritics.net, EveryonesACriticPodcast.com, IHateCritics.com. We're on Facebook. We have the Everyone's a Critic Movie Review Podcast Facebook page, and then the Everyone's a Critic Movie Review group. We're also on Twitter and Instagram. The handle is CriticsPod. There you can participate in our top fives, watch the trailers, read reviews, interact, fight, and all sorts of different things.
Call us cucks. Call us,
Does that happen?
No. We will now.
Yeah. Yeah. Next review, if you want to leave a review on Apple Podcasts, call us cucks.
I'm going to be out. What the hell does that mean? I've seen that so many times this week.
It means you like to let your, you have to watch your wife or girlfriend be with another person.
Because, oh, no. Oh.
That makes you.
All right. Yeah. All right. I get it.
So it's accurate, but. Anyway, we are on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Play. Listen to us on all the podcatchers. If you could, though, go to Apple Podcasts, subscribe, and rate and review the show. We'll read the review on the air. It helps us move up the charts. Patreon. I always forget the most important thing. IHateCritics.net/Patreon. It's the best way to help support the podcast. Get yourself a credit on the show. We'll read those at the end of every show. And hopefully we can knock out one or two bonus episodes, maybe even three. I have some ideas if the guys are up for it in the coming weeks. I'm not kidding this time. but we will see how our schedules align. Let's just start with the Star Wars Declaration of Nerd.
Nerd Rebellion?
Sure.
Yeah, Rebellion, with quotation marks.
And a capital R.
Yeah, that thing we read at the beginning of the show is a real thing.
They actually wrote that. Is that part of the whole Patreon campaign they have to raise money to make remake Star Wars?
How many people are involved in this? That's the thing I want to know.
Don't look at me, guys. I have no idea.
You're representing the fan base.
Sean has turned his back on it. You guys used to be on the same team.
Seriously, I have no clue what this is all about. I mean... I'm taking myself back to the night when The Last Jedi opened, and there were some, like, reasonably distressed people in terms of, like, yeah, that was really bad, or something like that, but not, like, throwing hats on the ground and stomping around like a little child throwing a temper tantrum.
Is that what,
like,
you do when you're
this
mad?
This
is. Is that what you did after Jurassic World?
In my head, yes. No, but, I mean, this is, I don't know, I just don't. I don't know anybody like this, let alone like a supposed fellowship of fans that like the same thing. I mean, gosh, I was all thinking about maybe drumming up interest in going to the celebration next year or whatever. But I mean, if I weren't run into like a single one of these people that constructed this, I'm going to want to leave. So
I got to the part. I didn't actually get to the part where they started talking about George Lucas, so that kind of, like, that jumped out at me, like, is this really somehow about defending George Lucas? I don't think so. No, this is about, there are girls in Star Wars, I don't like it.
Yeah, these same people shitted on his movies originally,
right?
So.
Yeah, where were these guys defending the second trilogy? If they're so happy, if they're so want to defend the nature of George Lucas on his behalf, what they've done with his characters, where were you during the? Yeah,
if I'm not mistaken, earlier on the podcast, I was the one defending George Lucas against all the Star Wars fans, saying, "Hey, the poor guy made $1 billion to give away something he loved, and now he's not happy." But I get not liking something, and I get, like, I was bummed, Josh. Didn't like Hereditary, but he's not writing a piece about how it should be banned and boycotted.
I am also not going to a theater manager and saying, where's the number I can call to get this removed from theaters?
Right. I get not liking something, and even if it's you're the minority, it doesn't really matter, but this is ridiculous.
It really is like just a hard self-own. You really look like fools right now. Just absolute utter fools. And don't give me this nonsense about they want to say that we're the part of the alt-right. You mentioned masculinity in this stupid thing. It's like an attack on masculinity. What are you supposed to be? What are people supposed to think when you come out with that nonsense? You sound like a men's rights activist. And if those guys aren't all on the right, I don't know where they are.
Right. No, I mean, I hate when you can, when a movie tries to be political and you can just see it all, you know, they're not doing it organically. That is annoying. I didn't feel that way with these movies. And not I didn't even like the first one.
I mean, even the smallest bit of inclusiveness that they do show, if you want to talk about feelings towards a robot in Solo or in The Last Jedi, you've got a variety of different races compared to just Caucasians stepping up to the forefront on the screen. It's kind of awesome. I mean, if you think about it, our favorite thing is... Our favorite thing, meaning like this supposed fan base, is at the forefront of blockbuster inclusiveness in a way. I mean, they're at least giving it their best shot. Therefore, it kind of really bugs me that they can't just accept that. It was supposed to be the thing that was inclusive for everyone, including girls. Like, whenever you could...
tried really hard.
Yeah,
watch Star Wars, please. We need girls.
As a child... if there was a girl in the neighborhood that wanted to play Star Wars or whatever, that was awesome. It was like, oh, you girls are allowed, you know, like, please join us with this because it would be great to have somebody play Leia or, you know, whatever the case may be. Assigning gender roles, you know, blah, 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 that's a separate issue. But back then, it was really cool to have girls involved.
You want to do this in a real way that could actually, I don't know if it could make a difference, but at least you wouldn't sound like a freaking idiot. Do some actual film criticism. Criticize the movies themselves. Point out where the movies are actually wrong instead of talking about themes that you're perceiving about empowerment or diversity that bother you. Speak about what's wrong with the movies. Just yeah, even write if you're a fucking review.
Even if you're attacking your nostalgic, you know, that I don't even think that's really accurate either. They didn't take away the original trilogy. That didn't go away. They're still there. Maybe you gotta go to VHS. I don't really know where they're at, but whatever. They're still somewhere. You can watch them. The memory is still there. Now, if you watched it and your memory went away and the movies disappeared forever, okay. Then you got a legit complaint here. But that didn't happen.
There's also a completely different dimension of material that you can gather. If you don't like the films, that's just one medium that you can acquire stories about your favorite characters. There's literally like 100 books post Return of the Jedi that you can read all about these people, and it's been going on for 20 plus years.
Now you're going too far.
Okay.
you want an illustration of just how silly this is that There are Twilight fans, right, who didn't like the Twilight movies. They loved the books. They didn't like the movies. So what did they do? They didn't boycott. They started writing fucking fan fiction and improving them stories themselves. Why don't you do that? That's a healthy outlet for you.
I wouldn't necessarily say improving. We did get the 50 Shades of Grey. But they,
I'm saying in their minds,
it was a creative outlet. Yeah. And that's fine. There's nothing.
That's a much more mature way of handling this.
We make fun of it, but we're probably the immature ones making fun of it.
Yeah, maybe the Twilight fan fiction is good. I haven't read it. I do know somebody, though, that is a big Twilight fan fiction person, though. I don't think I'm supposed to know, but I do know, and I would never say it on the air. But as I understand it, quite good at it as well and very popular. It's not E.L. James.
Well, she's very popular. Right. Good at it. Who knows? But
no.
Successful.
Yes.
But yeah, that's the podcast.
Thanks, everybody.
Sorry, world. Star Wars is still cool. Some of us are okay.
Let's get to our trailers. Beautiful Boy, Steve Carell.
Fantastic. What a great trailer. This looks like an amazing movie, and Carell looks like he's going to be awesome in it.
I forget the young actor's name who was in Call Me By Your Name.
Timothée Chalamet.
Chalamet, thank you. There's something about this that, boy, it really hit hard, even though I don't have a child that age or whatever. I just kept thinking about all of the possible avenues of parenting. No matter how hard you try, sometimes you just can't corral what your child does at a certain age, and this looks like that kind of movie. And I felt for both of the characters so hard just in the trailer alone. So it looks like it will be an incredible film.
And they shouldn't be surprised, because, you know, you look at guys like Johnny Depp and De Niro, who are just, they can barely form a sentence in real life. But you're watching this kid at the Oscars, and you're almost annoyed by how weird he is. But then you see him in these performances, and he turns into the characters like Depp and De Niro, and, you know, De Niro's peak. And it's just really impressive how great this kid is. And Steve Carell's, I've been liking the choices he's been making lately in terms of good movies. And then Mandy.
That is a messed up trailer, man. I have no idea what the hell's going on in this movie. I was hoping for an appearance by Barry Manilow, but that doesn't happen.
We know of.
Maybe, yeah. Maybe it'll be like the closing credits of Hereditary, so the song will pop in or something. But this is, I guess he's got a scythe and he's killing people and it's a post-apocalyptic future or something.
Well, if I try to tell you what was going on in the trailer, I would lead us down a rabbit hole. I don't care. It just looks bonkers, and there's a lot of blood. There's Nicolas Cage to the nth degree, and there's the guy from, I think it's 31, that Rob Zombie movie where
the clown guy. Yeah.
He's in this, in the trailer, and he bugs me. Like, he sincerely bugs me, not in like a bad way, like Sid Haig bugs me. This guy is like, I'm actually genuinely frightened of this man. And so I don't know what his involvement is in the movie, but every image that was on that little phone that I'm watching this trailer on, it was wonderful. And I wanted to watch it immediately. And I can't say that about every Nicolas Cage movie, because most of them look the quality of direct-to-video. This could be direct-to-video, but I don't care. I want to see it.
But does... sorry, go ahead.
I'm going to say some of this direct-to-video stuff is fantastic. Army of One.
Yeah, yeah.
Mom and Dad. People need to see these movies. They're just a ton of fun.
Does Crazy Nicolas Cage, the promise of Crazy Nicolas Cage, though, create a bar for this that is hard to gauge? Like, does it create an expectation that even he can't meet anymore?
I think so. But I think because the movie's crazy on top of it is what's weird about it. Like, with Army of One, it's kind of a straightforward movie with this crazy character. Even Mom and Dad had a crazy idea, but it was played straight with him going crazy. Bad Lieutenant was kind of crazy, though, all around, wasn't it?
He was much more restrained within the character, so.
And that's kind of it just seemed like if everything else is crazy and Nicolas Cage is crazy too, maybe it won't work. But if he can be crazy, and I don't really know what I'm trying to say, but I'm intrigued, if nothing else.
It is a great looking trailer. I don't know who the director is, though.
Panos Cosmatos. He's the son of, was it?
George P. Cosmatos of Tombstone fame.
Although, according to my brother, he didn't actually direct Tombstone. He just put his name on
Director of Leviathan.
Whatever. Yeah, there you go. Apparently, Kurt Russell directed Tombstone, and he was just there for the union credit. Whatever. I don't know either way. But yeah, hopefully we get a chance to see. He hasn't really done anything. I believe he was the cameraman on Tombstone. But that's kind of the extent of his Beyond the Black Rainbow. I don't know if either of you know what that is or not. He directed that, but they were playing him up in the trailer more than he probably deserved to be. Based on no credits.
It didn't say visionary director, did it?
I said something. They mentioned his name and something along those lines.
Uh-oh.
But he has only done one other movie, so it's hard to... A movie that sounds like none of us have heard of, so...
Well, you know, Ari Asher only has one movie, but he's a fucking visionary because Hereditary is amazing.
But we got to see it in the theater.
True.
That's my point.
We're not going to see this in the theater.
Especially not here.
Yeah, probably not.
Unless A24 picks it up or something.
Yeah, just quickly before we move on, just a piece of news that I want to shout this out because I wasn't able to mention it on the show when I reviewed the movie, but Night of the Virgin is now available for rent on Amazon Prime, $2.99. So if you want to get on there and see the movie that nearly made me puke but still loved, Night of the Virgin, one of the best movies of 2018, is now available for rent.
Was this your top movie?
Yeah, at the time it was.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I think I still think I have it above Hereditary, honestly. It's that level brilliant and gross and horrifying.
Yeah. Maybe I'll get to see it before one of the Patreon episodes and we'll bring it back. Sicario 2, or whatever, the Soldado.
Day of the Soldado. This is our sequel, of course, to the Sicario directed by Denis Villeneuve. And, of course, it's a big step down from that. This director is not nearly the visionary that Villeneuve is. He doesn't have his eye. He doesn't have his talent for pacing, his nose for a great character. And he just seems more eager to indulge the that masculine fantasy that people read into Taylor Sheridan's work, which I think it's more of an interpretation of his work than it is the actual text of the work, because really when you watch Hell or High Water, that seems to be more of who he is as a writer. I don't think this is representative particularly of his style and what he stands for, because this is a very standard action movie that has a lot of macho posturing to it, and he's about much more than that. The idea here is that Josh Brolin's character has been brought back to America to try and capture some, or try and get into the drug war and find out if the cartels are bringing terrorists across the border, and he's going to have to disrupt a cartel business to try and stop the flow of immigrants across and perhaps terrorists. The movie begins in this ludicrous fantasy of a terrorist blowing himself up on the border, and then terrorists blowing up a grocery store in Kansas City after having crossed the border with the help of drug dealers. And I'm not going to say that's utter nonsense, but I mean, to this point in our country, this is a fantasy, and particularly a right-wing fantasy of fear that they live with every day. They think this is going to happen to them every single day, apparently, some of these people. That's why they're arming themselves constantly. But this movie likes to play into that and use that fear and use that nonsense to try and sell a movie, which is really just makes this that much more sleazy and ugly. And then you've got these characters who we got to know a little bit in Sicario. And I'm not saying they were particularly complex, but they had an arc. They had a particular nastiness to them and a willingness to get the job done. And then this movie compromises who they are to make its ludicrous narrative work. And that's really unfortunate. I'm not going to say that Sicario is terrible, because portions of it's professional, and Del Toro and Brolin are professional. It is solidly constructed. It's just as a story, as characters, it's inconsistent, and the tone is kind of nonsense.
Compared to the first film, which was one of my top 10 of 2015, and is something that I see even as a violent film, is very rewatchable, akin to almost a horror film. And I'll say that again because of what I said the first time around in that first film. The sense of dread that Villeneuve creates throughout that entire film, instead of the bleak oranges and dust of deserts that you would think Mexico is, he's constantly got storms on the horizon and lightning and darkness surrounding that entire film. And so you kind of experience it through Emily Blunt's eyes. In this one, knowing that it's an intended trilogy of Taylor Sheridan's writing, I understand why it is the way that it is and paced so quickly the way that it is. What that means is you lose that buildup from the first film. You lose that mood that Villeneuve creates, and thus it becomes something of just an action film. Not that it's bad. It's very watchable, slightly more violent than the first film, I would say. Gory at some points as well. And there's an overall, like you said, masculinity to it that I wasn't expecting. The first film, while masculine, kind of sees that, because you're seeing the movie through Emily Blunt's eyes, as like, I guess that's what we're doing here. She's constantly challenging what everyone's doing. And in this one, that seems to be embraced to a certain extent. So the intelligence of the first film in wondering which is the best method to go about battling this is never confronted in this film, unfortunately. So the intelligence is lost. If you like action thrillers, it's for you. And Del Toro's performance as Alejandro, I really like this character. He's not just a guy that's out for revenge. You know, he's got some nuance to him. He's got a heart still. And he's also played very coolly, as only, I think, only Del Toro can do. He's got a particular cadence to his voice. The last thing I'll say about it, too, there's a subplot going on in both of these films. And, Sean, you may have caught it, because if you missed it, it wouldn't be your fault because it's so brief. The young man that keeps running into Del Toro throughout this sequel is the young man from the first film whose father was the police officer that Del Toro executed. And at the end, we see him playing soccer and whatnot, and you wonder what's going to happen there. Well, in this film, he's grown up a little bit. He gets into the cartel culture, and this subplot seems to be purposely linked by Sheridan to show you both sides of the story. So I'm interested to see how they wrap this up, but what I'd really like to see is bringing on a more skillful director to wrap this up, because I think the material is far better than this film is allowing it to be.
Yeah, I didn't see. Who directed it again?
A guy with the name two S's. SS are his initials. I couldn't tell you. I had never heard of him before.
Yeah, he's not a guy I've heard of either. I just think it's... I think the notion of what the masculine ideal... In the first film, they took that to a degree that I thought made sense. Here, I don't think they're willing to explore it, so it's more of a surface-level idea, and that's really unfortunate because there wasn't merely a critique in it. Like, they indulged it and allowed it to go to its natural lengths and kind of give you an idea of the sort of toxicity that comes from that particular all-out approach. I also, when it comes to this movie, because I just watched Sicario last week and wrote about it, and watching this one after that, what happens at the end of Sicario renders this movie to me more than a little bit unbelievable, because the what we're asked then to believe of Benicio del Toro based off of how Sicario ends and how this one goes, I didn't buy it. I don't buy him as a character with heart. I buy him as a character who's ready to kill anybody. I don't buy him as a character that has a conscience or a guy who has scruples about what he does.
It is a little confusing that in the first film they make us believe that he got his sought revenge and took care of it. And then in this one, they all of a sudden say, no, wait, that was just a piece of the puzzle. They're the ones that actually ordered the hit on my family. In this one, I'm going to go to the real source. I'm like, wait a minute, this guy's name wasn't even mentioned in the first film. Who the hell is actually running these cartels? You can just throw out a Latin American name and all of a sudden it'll work for the audience.
That also worked on me too. It's like I didn't quite follow that either.
There is a, I don't necessarily want to say right wing, but there is a particular undertone to this film that was really rubbing me the wrong way. This constant, well, you better do this. You better subscribe to what the characters in this film are doing, or you too will get blown up in your backyard in Arizona.
The director directed a movie called All Cops Are Bastards.
I had to get this one.
Yeah, I didn't see it, so I got nothing to add. But I did like Sicario, if that means anything. I guess it did make $19 million on a $35 million budget, so it did overperform this week, especially with Incredibles and Jurassic World out there.
Put your top five. Who's your top five?
This week's top five is Assassins, Hitmen, Hitwomen. We do have an Instagram post that I have here somewhere.
Oh, I know this person. I found out that a friend of mine from long ago, like 1999, okay, she was my ex-wife's roommate in college, and all of a sudden I see this username pop. I'm like, why do I know that? And then all of a sudden she contributes something on our page. I'm like, oh my gosh, it's you! I haven't talked to you in a long time. So, Sarah, please read her list.
Sarah Ward, number 5, the T-1000 from Terminator 2, 4, John Wick, 3, Jewels, from Pulp Fiction, 2, the T-800 from Terminator, and 1, Anton Chigurh from No Country from Old Men. On our Facebook page, we have Cousin Jeff, Vincent Vega, Leon, Nikita, Maggie, Django Fett, Jules Winfield, Ian Britt went to our Facebook page instead of our Instagram, so we don't skip him. Vincent from Collateral, Anton from No Country from Old Men, Travis Bickle, Taxi Driver, John Wick, Jules Winfield, with an honorable mention to Arthur Bishop from The Mechanic, Uncle Jeff. He had Mr. Smith, number 5, Mrs. Smith, number 4, number 3, Charlie Partana from Prizzi's Honor, 2, Cheech from Bullets Over Broadway, number 1, Anton Chigurh from No Country for Old Men. Beth had Martin Blank from Gross Point Blank, Jules Winfield from Pulp Fiction, 3, Nikita, 2, T-800. God, I keep clicking on things and it's popping up Model 101 from Terminator, and then number 1, Beatrix Kiddo from Kill Bill. And then I had number 5, Angel Eyes from The Good, The Bad, The Ugly, 4, Leon, 3, Anton Chigurh, 2, Jules Winfield, and 1, Brett. Go ahead, Josh, do you have yours?
Brett Michaels? Please explain yourself, sir. I don't know this.
I don't need to.
Brett the Hitman Hart.
From Wrestling with Shadows.
I don't know who that is. Oh, wait, that's a wrestler, right?
He's also the excellence of execution.
Oh, my good God. Very interesting.
Do I need to read yours?
You do. Right?
You had 5, Ray, such Bullseye, In Bruges, Daredevil, Colin Farrell. Number 4, Alejandro from Sicario. 3, Anton Chigurh. 2, the entire Deadly Viper Assassination Squad, except L. Driver from Kill Bill. And number 1, Jules from Pulp Fiction.
I got a weird soft spot for Bridget Fonda's Point of No Return. I know it's a remake of La Femme Nikita, and that's probably the movie that I should like, but Bridget Fonda, I really, really liked her in Point of No Return to a degree that most people do not. Martin Blank, obviously, from Gross Point Blank. The Bride from Kill Bill. John Wick is incredible. Jules. There's a lot of really good ones out there that it's a really fun topic because there are a lot of very interesting killers. I also liked, and I know this one is very controversial, but Clive Owen's character from Shoot 'Em Up is a guilty pleasure of mine because that movie is utterly ridiculous, and I think people overlooked it. And Colonel Willard from Apocalypse Now. People forget that he was assigned to assassinate Marlon Brando in that movie.
I have not seen Shoot 'Em Up, but I am a big Clive Owen fan, and I keep introducing myself to stuff of his that really sucks. And so if Shoot 'Em Up is worth it, I would watch it.
Most people hate it. Just so you know, most people hate it. He's like Bugs Bunny as an assassin. Like, that's how crazy that movie is.
I could probably get it. That's Paul Giamatti too, right?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, it is. It's in many ways it's bad, but I like the fact that that movie rides like this razor line between being the worst movie and a really good movie.
Which leads me to, I'm only going to say one of my honorable mentions, and it's Antonio Banderas in Assassins. That is such a terrible, terrible movie, but also could be really good. And he's just so bonkers, like swearing every other word, and he's so sweaty, and he's so angry all the time. And it's one of my favorite Antonio Banderas performances.
Wasn't he also a hitman in Desperado?
Yes, of course. That whole trilogy or whatever is involving an assassin.
And he's much better than that one.
Yeah, much, I would say.
Although I do like Assassins, too. I mean, Stallone, in a lot of ways, is responsible for Sandra Bullock and Julianne Moore. If you think about it.
Well, I'm going to let The Fugitive also be responsible for Julianne Moore. You know,
how long before that, though? That seemed
2 years.
And she didn't really do anything for 2 years.
Fair.
Blew up right after Assassin.
I would say that independent film did far more for Julianne Moore than either of those movies.
Eventually. Made her a household name. Uncle Drew.
Uncle Drew. This is a movie that is based off of a Pepsi commercial. The idea here was that, I think it was in 2016, they dressed up Kyrie Irving and the Cleveland Cavaliers in old man makeup and sent him out to parks to play against kids and kind of shock the kids. Hey, how's this old man beating us? He's so amazing. Clever commercial, played great during the All-Star game and the playoffs and whatnot, and then it seemed to go away. And for some reason, somebody thought, let's make a movie of that. That sounds like a great idea. And I think part of it was, and I can't prove this, but I think it was inspired by Bad Grandpa, the Johnny Knoxville movie, which was made for a $15 million budget and made $115 million, if you didn't know. So it was a monster hit, Bad Grandpa. So I think they took the idea of that with a young guy in old man makeup and decided, well, if that's a hit, I'm sure we could do this cheap and make it a hit. And lo and behold, they made this for like 10, 15 million bucks, and it made 15 million this weekend, and who knows how much it'll make overall. But the bottom line here is this movie should not be good, and in many ways it's not, but I loved it. It's a genial, sweet, funny movie. It has everything in a movie that I should hate. There's a gathering the team montage. There's a dance sequence. There's a big game at the end that you know they're going to win. And yet, I still really enjoyed these characters. Lil Rel Howery from Get Out plays Dax, who's got to put together a team for this tournament in New York called the Rucker, which is this famous streetball tournament. And his team gets taken away from him early on by Nick Kroll, who's his rival. He's got to go out and find some players, and he finds Uncle Drew and sees Uncle Drew play against some kids and schools them. So he takes Uncle Drew, and that's going to be on his team. And Uncle Drew then insists that he wants his team. So he's got to go get Preacher, played by Chris Webber, and Lights, played by Reggie Miller, and Boots, played by Nate Robinson, and Big Fella, played by Shaquille O'Neal. And these scenes of him gathering this team, as corny as this notion is of this gathering the team montage, is so silly and so fun. It was infectious. Reggie Miller is having such a great time. You see him first in a Dave and Buster's just tossing the ball everywhere while he's playing the Papa Shot. He's just throwing the ball over like because he can't see. So his character's essentially blind. Then you see Shaq, and Shaq's doing karate.
Shaq Fu?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that's pretty funny. And Chris Webber and Lisa Leslie are a couple in the movie. Lisa Leslie, also a basketball legend from the WNBA. And the two of them have great chemistry. They're very funny as this old bickering couple, him being the henpecked husband, which is getting another stupid trope, but it's funny watching him do it because he's not an actor, I guess, maybe. There's some visual invention to this. There's a real care with the makeup. They give a damn about making that work, and I liked this movie. I shouldn't like this movie, but I liked it.
It sounds like it would actually be kind of fun. Kyrie Irving is kind of an eccentric personality, and I mean,
and
I watched
like the Earth is Hollow or something.
Eccentric personality. He's a flat earther.
Flat earth, that's it.
But I watched Reggie Miller act on the court for like 15, 16 years, so he's a natural, I'm sure, on the screen.
Someone's a Bulls fan.
Yeah. A little bit. He had the flailing arm thing like down to
a
T.
He's a soccer player.
Yeah.
I wish somebody would have mentioned that in the movie. They don't, but they do. Poor Chris Webber's never going to be let to live down that timeout thing, so they got to relive that joke.
Funny thing though, I didn't
it
see
is
the movie,
funny,
but I gotta imagine it was funny. It's certified. I don't know if certified fresh, but it's a fresh movie on Rotten Tomatoes.
Really,
on both critics and audience, almost the same exact score. So,
it's fun. It's really dumb, but it's really fun. And these guys are having such a great time. You can't help but kind of have a great time as well.
So Shaq is finally in a movie that we can all probably enjoy. Finally.
Finally.
You guys didn't like Blue Chips?
No. Oh, no.
I didn't mind Blue Chips up until now. It's probably the best thing Shaq's been involved in.
Wasn't that the first thing he did?
Perhaps, yeah.
Oh, yeah, I think so. And Anthony Hardaway was in it, too. And
there's Kazam, there's Steel, and the Grown Ups movies. Not a great resume.
How do you not capture the fun they had on the set of Grown Ups like they do here? Whatever. Escape Plan 2, speaking of fun on set.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. They had a lot of fun with the terrible special effects and god-awful sets of this movie. This is such a cheap, piece of crap. This must have been made for about $2, honestly. It looks like they borrowed the sets from Space Mutiny and decided to make a prison movie. It's terrible. This is a terrible movie. Sylvester Stallone is back from the character that he played in the movie opposite Schwarzenegger a couple of years ago. He's Ray. He's a prison expert. He's hired to break out of prisons to show people how not to break out of prisons. And here he's battling one of his former employees who's built a prison that he thinks Ray can't get out of. And who the fuck cares? This movie is terrible. There's the direction is amateur to a degree that explains why this movie wasn't released theatrically, because it is that level of amateur direction. He makes everybody in the movie look bad, including Stallone, just through his inability to frame a shot properly. The editing is abysmal. Like I said, the production design is among the worst of the year. I don't understand how anybody thought this was even releasable, even as a straight-to-DVD movie. This was going to be a theatrical release, and I think they watched it, and they go, oh, shit, we need to bury this as quickly as possible and quietly as possible. Don't let anybody see this. Just kind of sneak it out there.
I don't know if that's their intention, because I went to Family Video, and there was a wall full of this movie. Sold out, mind you. So they made their $2 back. So I just had a hard time. I couldn't make myself spend $6 to rent it on Amazon.
Right.
So, but every time I went to a Redbox, it was gone. So, I mean, good for them, I guess. The guy, the director.
They've definitely sold everybody a bill of goods.
The director remade Silent Night, Deadly Night, which was not very good. And I recognize nothing else on his IMDb page. Nothing, yeah.
Yeah, it's... For how long it is, for how long his resume is, it's not very recognizable. And there's a reason for that. He can't direct a movie.
No, I never did see the first one, but if you pair those two together, of course, I'm at least semi-interested. Is the first one worth watching?
Compared to this?
Well, on its own merit.
I mean,
let's just say if my baseline is Expendables is terrible and I hate it.
I would say watch this before Expendables.
Okay.
Even this one?
No. The first Escape Plan. No, you watch 10 Expendables before you watch this.
Well, yeah, to me, Expendables is grown-ups for action movies. Sure, it's a shit ton of fun on set, but what the hell happened?
Right?
How did this movie not work?
Well, speaking of Expendables, apparently Expendables 4 is not going to happen now. Apparently. I mean, there's still talk of it, but apparently this whole thing about Terry Crews, they're going to end up sinking the movie.
Huh. I mean, at some point, he is, what, 72, Stallone?
I mean, with the hormones, he's probably about 105, but he looks 72.
He looks like a 55-year-old Ric Flair.
Even I know what that... Okay.
You'd think he'd look more like Hulk Hogan. He's just not as... I don't know. I watched Grudge Match the other day. What a good movie. Yeah, Escape Plan 2 came out.
Don't see it. Don't throw your money away.
But what I guess I fear is if it made its money on video, which maybe they don't count that. I don't know how they do that. But
I mean, they only care if it makes back its budget. And since it cost about $5 to make, I think they'll probably make another one.
So now Stephen C. Miller is a successful director. Yay.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is the main event for the linear, legitimate, and universally recognized Undisputed Classic.
Our Undisputed Classic this week is Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas.
Yes, Terry Gilliam directed 1996, was it? 98. And starring Johnny Depp in the role of... Hunter S. Thompson, or Raoul Duke, his alter ego, and Benicio del Toro, who inspired this choice as Dr. Gonzo, who may or may not have existed. There's a lot of innuendo and rumor about who Dr. Gonzo may be like a combination of, or if he was a real person. It's unknown, but Hunter S. Thompson could have dreamed up this guy in a drug-fueled haze, and this is what he dreamed of. Because that's all Fear and Loathing is just this it's a dream sequence, essentially, from beginning to end, a drug-fueled dream sequence. He takes a bunch of drugs, heads to Las Vegas, supposedly to cover a dirt bike race, which at the very least he tried to do. But he's so wasted the whole time that really he's more interested in writing about being wasted at a motorcycle race than he is about the actual motorcycle race, which if you're Rolling Stone, that's actually kind of works out, really. That's kind of a better...
The problem with Sports Illustrated hired him. Okay. I think in this movie, Sporting News. But so they rejected the piece and ended up going to Rolling Stone instead. But he, at this point, he was famous for whatever he wrote about, or it was a Hell's Angel thing. He went and joined them, and he always wrote about his experience within something. So that's kind of what this movie was. It's him writing about this from a distance while you're watching it happen on screen, which I found neat.
Yeah, I loved the narration by Johnny Depp. I thought that was really, really captured the inner voice of Hunter Thompson. And this, you couldn't possibly capture Fear and Loathing better, I would say, the Hunter S. Thompson writing. You can't capture it better in visual form than the way Gilliam does it, with these fisheye lenses and these melting backgrounds and these monstrous characters who grow from normal looking to these amazing Monty Python caricatures. They really, I don't think any other director could have pulled this off the way he does. To make this an incredible cult classic.
Interestingly enough, I hadn't seen this before, and so knowing a lot about it through the lens of other people's opinions set me up for failure to begin with, because I already didn't like it as kind of like a stoner druggy type thing. I don't get into that. It really kind of bugs me. But putting that aside, in now that I'm a little older, coming to this with kind of an open mind helped a little bit. Yes, it's like a fever dream. Yes, it's like a kind of incomprehensible most of the time as to what's actually going on. There's no like in between scenes. You know, it's just an hour and 58 minutes of take it all in, man. Because if you want structure, you're not going to get it with this film. It's just going to be randomness to the nth degree. What I did like about it is the blending scenes and stuff like that. There's some neat special effects in this movie for whatever reason. It's weird to say that because you don't necessarily go to see Fear and Loathing Las Vegas for the great special effects, but they really worked for me. I was kind of taken aback by a few things, including in the casino when they're checking in and he starts to see lizard people walking all around. Now, doing a little bit of research on this, I noticed that the creature designer is Rob Bottin, and he's a famous creature designer, like for The Thing and whatnot. And so those lizards genuinely creeped me out. I don't know if it accessed my primal brain and something that I've dreamt about before, but a lot of this movie is about the primal brain, I would imagine. It's more this idea of Hunter S. Thompson that I'm trying to work through and what his importance is, and thus what is the importance of the film. I think I get it now. It's more along the lines of, well, everything's screwed up around me. I might as well get screwed up too and tell everybody what I'm experiencing. And if I take it that way, then I'm not so high and mighty, get off my lawn type guy as a critic watching this.
I think that's his intent.
I'm getting that too. And if I look at it that way, then it's kind of brilliant in a way. If everyone else is screwed up, then I might as well just be screwed up too. Is a man who had his funeral paid for by Johnny Depp and his ashes were shot out of a cannon. Like, okay, I think I'm down for this guy now. Finding out a lot more about him, this idea of gonzo journalism, where you just go and experience something as opposed to worrying about the structure and narrative of traditional journalistic news loops. Okay, I think I'm cool with it, and I understand why somebody else would be into that as well. It generated a couple of comments just from posting that on Instagram saying, oh, I really love this. I watch this movie a lot. Well, good for you. I can't imagine watching it a lot, okay? But if you're kind of experiencing the world as, boy, a lot of messed up stuff happens, man, you might want to see it through the eyes of Hunter S. Thompson. It might make the world a little easier for you. So it's a good experience to have watched this. Now I kind of have my mind opened up a little more than I did before. So do I consider it a classic? No. but it was eminently way more watchable than I expected.
I saw this in theaters, and seeing it on the big screen is actually a much different experience than seeing it on TV, because you walked out of the theater out of the dark with that all-encompassing vision in front of you, and it is like a trip. When you walk out, I walked outside, and I was just kind of blinking, trying to bring the universe back into a normal frame, because I was so...
Cocaine's a hell of a drug, Sean.
And I've never been on drugs. Never in my life have I used any kind of illegal drug. So I had no frame of reference in that way, but I was still... It was the fisheye lens stuff, the way he uses his camera kind of floating around in the same way the characters are, it really does put you in the mind of these characters in a way that is oppressive almost. What appeals to me most about this movie, though, is the humor, the structure of the humor, the jokes. There's no traditional joke. It's just what he's doing is inherently hilarious because he has such a strange perspective, and he's in no position to judge anybody. But it is kind of all judgmental of these squares who aren't as tripped out as he is. I love the stuff at the District Attorney's Convention, which is so, what a funny, that is a genuinely funny scene, just beginning to end, his running commentary, what happens, what he's listening to, the ludicrous marijuana PSA that's going on in front of him while he's tripping balls, is just, it's hilarious, and it's not, there are no jokes, like, he's not making any jokes, it's just hilarious just the way it's presented, and I really enjoy humor like that.
Well, yeah, and his narration was almost from the voice of a sober guy, you know? So you have this sober person narrating his drug-fueled experiences. And, I mean, I tried looking up stuff on him, and I don't know that everything he wrote was about a drug-fueled haze. I knew this was. And it seemed like part of it was he's in Vegas trying to search for happiness in the fakest place in the world, so that was part of it. And then the other thing was it was kind of explaining why the 60s drug revolution failed. And I think the last line of the movie kind of answers that, I guess. Mm-hmm. But so I guess there are points to it without there being a story. But I don't know. I just found it way more intriguing this time. And I didn't dislike it the first time. I liked it. But I'm definitely more interested in him, having not read anything of his, really, other than maybe a few small articles here and there.
I used to read – he actually wrote a column for ESPN for a long time, and I used to read that. And I mean, the thing that defined him was kind of this sort of ironic bitterness that he had about the way that the 60s failed, and also this bizarre perspective on masculinity, where he didn't really care about what was macho. At the same time, he was a macho ideal for himself, which is like kind of an interesting perspective.
Yeah, a guy that really loved he loved firearms, as I understand. And I watched a clip of him and Conan O'Brien going out into nowhere and firing guns, and Conan like, oh my god, I'm around this guy that's tripping balls and he's firing these large weapons at things. And that was very entertaining. And when he was on Conan's show, you could see that he wasn't there. Like, he was there, but he was not there. I don't know if that meant that his brain was mush or if he was just, you know, literally on something at that time, but dude couldn't sit still. He didn't know where his chair was. The conversation was just crazy.
But at the same time, he wasn't, you know, you see your Kurt Cobains and your, you know, guys like that. Mm-hmm. He didn't seem like that kind of a drug addict. He seemed more like he could handle whatever high he had. I mean, he died because he killed himself because he was sick, mm-hmm. you know, nothing to do with drugs. Other than that, might have made the process easier. But it's just kind of weird. I mean, I don't know. He definitely seemed to be the kind of guy that knew how to handle his high in a weird way of saying that. But you just didn't hear him getting in trouble.
That is also true, which is
weird.
Why going into the film, I'm like, yeah, how is he never in trouble yet is talking about all these things that he's doing? Wouldn't you shadow the dude and then arrest him at some point? But no, that's just not the way it works because he's famous.
Well, and drugs shouldn't be illegal. I mean, that's the other thing.
Fair enough. I can agree with you on that.
I mean, the whole scene, him running from the cops, people don't know how to handle when a cop's pulling you over. That was amazing.
My favorite scene is him trying to escape this hotel manager in his car, and the hotel manager just keeps stopping him, and he's trying to get out. And he keeps slamming on the gas and then stopping and slamming on it. Oh, that was an amusing scene.
And we haven't really talked about Benicio del Toro at all, though.
Really, but he's like a horror film character at times. You think maybe he could go full on Manson family at certain points.
The dude, but psycho.
Right. Yeah, that scene with the little girl. Just like, what the fuck?
I love that Ted Thompson is forced to be the adult in the room at this point. It's freaking hilarious. He's tripping like ball, just crazy, and he's got to be the one who says, okay, we need to get her out of the room and get her into another hotel and get as far away from us as possible.
But yeah, I find it to be a really neat movie. I get why it's a classic in certain ways, and glad we revisited it again. And I could see why people watch it, because it is a watchable movie, and it's...
Yeah, imagine this film turning out the way that it was originally intended by the original director. As I understand, Alex Cox of Sid and Nancy was first on the project and did not finish it. And he's credited with part of the screenplay here, but knowing Sid and Nancy and knowing Terry Gilliam, those are two very different films. Yeah.
I could see that working in its own way, but not like this. I mean, Where the Buffalo Roam in a lot of ways is kind of loosely based on that book.
Yeah, I learned about that the first time this week too, and I feel like I probably should get into it because it's Bill Murray.
But it's Bill Murray, and have you heard of that movie until this week?
No.
Right. There's a reason for that.
Oh, I see.
This movie made $18 million off of a $15 million budget, but on Blu-ray, DVD, VHS, it became a cult classic. It's one of those movies that people revisit constantly, and you go to a video store, you can't get this movie because it's always out.
Is this the movie that kind of broke Benicio del Toro, or
one? Yeah, I would say so. I mean, he did this, then he had that brief bit in The Pledge, and then Traffic in 2000.
It's hard to... It probably did, but 3 years prior to that, he was part of the Usual Suspects team.
Oh, that's true.
And he had been in a Bond movie back in 89 as one of the...
That doesn't count.
Well, in terms of exposure, right? I mean,
right.
People
like
would know his
Samuel
face.
L. Jackson broke out from Coming to America.
Okay, that's fair. But at least he'd been on screen and whatnot. But like in 1997, Excess Baggage with Alicia Silverstone didn't make the impact that this did. And then obviously Traffic. But he's been in both Marvel and in Star Wars, too. He's made it.
You gotta ruin everybody.
That was just for you.
Number 18 in 1988. Squeezed and pulled and hurt my neck in 1988.
Squeezed and pulled and hurt your neck in 1988.
Oh, there's some movie with Kristen Scott Thomas that looked really stuffy and British, and so I didn't bother watching it.
It was called A Handful of Dust.
Yeah.
What a terrible name for a movie. Almost as bad as the Martin Sheen movie.
I wonder if that's the movie Eddie Izzard refers to in his comedy special where he's talking about British people sitting in rooms counting matches.
I would believe it because I just couldn't get past the title and the Kristen's got Thomas bores the bejesus out of me and she's in The English Patient too. And I just couldn't bear to sit through it. So I decided not to even try
it
and find
it. It kind of sounds like the summary is the wife's affair and a death in the family hasten the demise of an upper class English marriage. So that's very possible with this movie.
Just peel some wallpaper for 2 hours. It'll probably be the same event. Another one from 88 that didn't crack a million is called Da. I don't know. There's something creepy about this. It just doesn't sound right. Like Martin Sheen is having reflections of his dad or something like that, who he used to call that. It seems like something that would work on stage maybe. And in fact, Martin Sheen plays a playwright in this. So I feel like maybe this was on the stage at some point and they brought it to the theater. But as I said, under a million in gross. But... Coming to America turns 30 this week, and I saw it for the first time. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I had seen the Soul Glow commercial, and that was very amusing, to the point where I knew to sing with it when it came on the screen, okay? Like, in my head, because I can't hit those notes, man.
Dude, but we have a Patreon thing. We can sell that stuff. Record yourself doing this shit next just time.
No. I got to grab something a little tighter for that to happen.
Patreon.
This is a John Landis film. He of the Thriller music video and other things. Stars Eddie Murphy and Arsenio Hall and James Earl Jones, and not starring Samuel L. Jackson, but he's in it.
Oh yeah.
Amongst other, John Amos is in here as well, and
Louis Anderson. Don't forget Louis Anderson.
Yes, actually, funny for once.
Emmy Award winner, by the way. Just saying.
Hilarious comedian.
I'm sure. but Eddie Murphy plays a prince who does not want the marriage that's going to be forced on him by his father, played by, of course, James Earl Jones. He can only play fatherly characters with his deep, rolling voice. And instead, he wants to go to America and find an American woman. Now, there are patches of this film that are unbelievably funny, like bust out loud funny. For example, the first big laugh that I got was realizing that the phrase, "the royal penis is clean, your highness," okay, that's a part of a Ludacris song, and I always thought that Ludacris came up with it, but no, it's from Coming to America. There are so many little patches of great humor in this movie, and Eddie Murphy is constantly charismatic and joyous in this one. I mean, vulgar stuff is happening around him, and he just stays the same character throughout. And Arsenio Hall is very funny. In fact, all of the characters that Eddie Murphy and Arsenio Hall play in the barbershop that is central to this film are very funny, okay? The plot itself, it doesn't really matter. I mean, what happens there, it's a matter of these little bits that are essentially skits that come together to form a complete film. And I found myself really, really, really enjoying it to the point where I think I want to watch it again soon.
This is a landmark for Eddie Murphy, because this is marks the end of that amazing 80s run that began with 48 Hours and Trading Places, the Beverly Hills Cops movies, the first two, that were all, aside from Golden Child, all like $100 million hits. And this is the last one that he hit with. After this, it's another 48 Hours and straight downhill until he gets to
the kid era.
The kid era, yeah. The Last Refuge of Scoundrels, that is the family film.
But those made $100 million too, didn't they?
The Last Refuge of Scoundrels, nevertheless. But I like this movie a lot. I think it's, like Josh said, it's got a lot of really funny stuff. To this day, in my head, I'll just hear the words "sexual chocolate" and just bust up laughing. But what's great about that scene, I mean, it's as great as the song is and the performance by Eddie Murphy, the introduction that genuine introduction that Arsenio Hall gives him, just trying to sell this guy to this crowd that has no interest in him, is brilliant. It is some of Arsenio's best work, is that moment with that preacher character. So much of this is so funny, and what's striking to me about Eddie Murphy's performance is this is such a gentle, genuine performance, because before this, he's known for being the smartest guy in the room, that the Bugs Bunny character. He's outsmarting everybody. He's kind of verbally nasty to people, and he looks down on everybody. Here he's so happy and so bright and so joyous, and he's a romantic lead, a genuine,
he's a straight man.
Romantic lead. Yeah, everybody else gets to do the other stuff, and he's so deft at it. And you wonder why he never pulls this out of the bag again in the rest of his career, or prior to this, he never pulled this out, because he can do this. And there is an element of this movie that could be so much better in terms of his character and his journey, because they could make this more of a kind of a fairy tale that could be still kind of vulgar and play to that audience. But I think they take the easy way out so many times and going for those easy jokes throughout.
Yeah, that's a good way to say it. You said it better than I would, which was I was thinking it was a bunch of skits compiled together. It just, they go for the easy way out to the next scene instead of making it more of a fluid film.
Right. And I think maybe, I don't know if that comes to with the fact that they cast the wrong woman to be his love interest, because she's kind of a boring actress, Cherie Headley. She doesn't really have much to do. Maybe it's just an underwritten character. I wanted to meet her, but the character just isn't there. And the romance fails because her character doesn't rise up to meet his character. And that's really where the movie is lacking. But it's also lacking narratively, because, again, they do seek out the easiest possible joke in any scene and go for that. And that works, like, for kind of sitcom chuckles, but this movie could have been more than that. That said, I still like this movie a lot, because it's still very funny. But the jokes are easy. And given the ambition of everything else in the movie, this movie earned 2 Academy Awards nominations for production design and costume, which are big, ambitious things. The castle in Zamunda, the African wedding, are elaborate scenes that definitely no surprise that they got Academy attention. And that's very big and ambitious. The rest of the movie completely lacks that ambition in terms of the comedy.
Yeah, I noticed the costume designer was Deborah Nadelman or whatnot.
Right.
She's responsible for the Indiana Jones movies and the costume design there. That's a huge blockbuster film, and here she is doing Coming to America. You could see it, too.
This was a blockbuster, too.
Yeah.
Indeed it was. Released in the middle of summer, I can understand that. I guess what I'm saying is I don't expect that in a comedy to have such vast production value.
Yeah, no, it's one of, I don't even remember the first time I saw it. We had a poster that we got from Hogan's Video in Geneseo that was, it was bigger than I am now. I mean, it was like, if I put up in this basement, I'd go to the ceiling onto the floor and kind of wrap around. It was so huge. I don't even know why we got it. I was like 10.
Yeah.
At that point, I'm 38 now, so at 8 came to the theater, 9, 10, finally was out of the the posters are coming down from the video stores. But I don't remember. I know, because I've seen it so many times that I just don't know when the first time was. But I also know I wasn't watching R-rated movies that much as a kid. So I don't really, maybe I must have seen TV versions of it, but it is just such a fun movie. I just think the female lead is underwritten, because they just don't spend much time with her.
Yeah.
And Eric LaSalle's character is so one-dimensional. <Yeah. laughs>
But it's a great dimension for a running gag.
But that's the thing. I think they went with comedy over story. And but it doesn't affect the watchability of the movie. It just affects it from being, I don't know.
It could have been better. It's good. It could have been great.
But would it have made less money if it was good, great instead of good?
Maybe.
You know what I'm saying?
I would love to see the Ernst Lubitsch take on this movie. And I know that's kind of a deep cut for film fans, but this is the kind of thing that he would have dealt with and done really deftly and funny in a 1940s kind of way. I saw this movie on HBO, by the way, when I was a kid. I didn't get to see this one in theaters because it was R-rated. And
well, you'd have been like, what, 10?
12.
11, 12?
Yeah.
You're that much older than me.
I was 12, so I didn't get to see this in theaters, but I did see it on HBO 1,000 times. And I had a smaller version of the poster that you had.
It's actually my brother's. It was like, here we are, these 10 and 9-year-old kids with this poster that's bigger than our room.
Yeah, there's another thing, too, is John Amos runs McDowell's restaurant. Now, back when Chappelle's Show appeared, and he had this whole skit about being at Whack Arnold's, and I thought that was so brilliant at the time, and I really enjoyed the flipping it on its head. But this was done like 15 years before Chappelle's Show did it in that particular fashion. It's a running little joke that doesn't really matter a whole lot, but it got me cracking up every time. I just couldn't help but see, like, they have arches. We have
arcs.
Yeah, no, I was really happy to get to watch this movie this week, and I can't wait to watch it again.
And we're not going to see Eddie Murphy for the rest of the 80s.
Well, it's... What's this next run like? Those
another 48 hours comes out in 1990, and then Boomerang in 92, and Distinguished Gentleman after that.
Distinguished Gentleman's phenomenal, though. I don't. Maybe it did make
it didn't make any money,
but it is a great movie that really is relevant today. You haven't seen
that. I haven't seen that.
Some
either.
Of it, again, that movie's plagued by a similar go for the joke idea, though.
Oh, yeah, but still, it's there's enough of it. I agree. It's not a Academy Award winning worthy film, but it's still just the premise, I guess, is relevant more than absolutely. Anything. I wish Eddie Murphy would come back.
You know, I remember just
Dream Girl. Like, Dream Girl's is really great. I mean. I know what you mean, but I wish he was a main star now. I agree.
Not to get too far into a distinguished gentleman tangent, but I was so hyped for that movie because I thought, this is it. This is the one. Eddie's back now. This is going to be the Eddie we've been waiting for. And it kind of was, but something about it just didn't, like, it didn't feel like Beverly Hills Cop or... Just didn't quite. I was bummed when I walked out of it. Like, that was okay.
Yeah, see, I saw it way later. Like, I was probably a late teens or something like that when I finally saw that one, and it just kind of caught me off guard. I didn't have any agenda behind it, but it was just kind of. It's a Norbit's fun.
All right, this podcast is over. Fuck you.
Find a way to make that a classic one.
It'll turn 30 someday.
Fuck Norbit so hard.
Oh, it's I hate not Norbit. That bad.
I hate Norbit. It's so terrible.
No, it's okay.
What a piece of shit.
Next week, we've got the first Purge. It's the main movie. And then, what, Ant-Man and the Wasp?
That other movie?
That might make $30
million. That's this week's Uncle Drew.
Right. Ant-Man and the Wasp. Jurassic Park will still be number one.
You know what's really weird about Ant-Man and the Wasp? Speaking of marketing and expectations of box office, though, is a guy that is in tune with the marketing machine, because I'll often go to look at the merchandise for these comic book films. You can't find Ant-Man and the Wasp stuff out there. Maybe it's like too close to Infinity War. I don't know how these cycles work, but it's available online, but it's not at retail, especially around here. That's weird.
I know at the theater, they sold out. Our local theater in Davenport sold out completely of Ant-Man stuff, like right off the bat.
Okay, well, that's good. That brings me a little more hope.
Well, I mean, it'll be successful.
Per se, because hope. Man, that is not intended. But.
And then our undisputed classic is Society.
Yeah, I was looking for a weird sort of movie to pair with The Purge, because there's really nothing you can pair with Ant-Man,
Ants,
the Wasp.
Suzanne Summers. It's an old horror movie. I think the cover is just her boobs covered in ants.
If you'd said something a week ago, no. I was looking up movies that are similar to The Purge, and Society popped up from actually in 1989, oddly enough, and it's supposed to be kind of brutal and similar theme as The Purge, so I thought, why not? Plus, Eddie Warlock from Baywatch is in it, so...
if I'm not mistaken, it's free on Amazon Prime.
So there, it's got all these things going for it. It's called Society. Look it up and join us. Play the Everyone's a Critic home game.
Then our top five is Craziest Deaths.
Yeah, so like the guy crawling through barbed wire in Saw, or the guy who gets his arms and legs twisted off in Saw, or maybe... The
guy cutting his own leg off in Saw, or originally Mad Max.
The guy getting his jaw ripped open in Saw.
The Achilles tendon scene in Glorious Bastards or whatever. Or no, it was Hostiles ended up using that. It must have been cut from something Tarantino did.
I haven't seen enough horror films to really make this a good list, but I'll give it my best shot.
Was it Friday the 13th? The guy gets the chain wrapped around his eyes around the tree, and then Jason like twists the piece of wood and pulls back on the chain around the guy's eyes and explodes his head. That one's pretty good. Kevin Bacon with the arrow through the throat.
Yeah. How did Johnny Depp just? Turn into a pool of blood.
He explodes. Yeah, he's a blood geyser in Nightmare on Elm Street.
So there's plenty of
I think there's plenty of opportunities there.
And Stallone knocks off Wesley Snipes' head in Demolition Man. Not memorable at all. But Or in Cliffhanger when he drops his the friend's fiance.
The snap of Apollo Creed's neck as he gets hit by Drago. Oh, sorry.
Right. It's innocent people death. But it's not.
Just so we've turned the corner.
Wow, that got dark.
Oh, I want to make a joke that I'm not going to make. So, I want to thank our Patreon supporters. We'll start with Jason Bryant and Charlie Messing at our key grip level. Our character actors, Josh and Christina.
I think this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship.
Our special effect level, Corey.
May the Force be with you.
Our associate producer, Jason from New Mexico.
Everybody has to eat shaving cream once in a while.
And our movie stars, Dave Seavers and Uncle Jeff.
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Then if you want to be a Patreon supporter, ihatecritics.net/Patreon. It's the best way to help support the podcast. Give as little or as much as you can, and we'll try to make it worth your while. If nothing else, you are helping support production costs that do add up and go into the movies costs for most of us. Basically, our show then. We'll see you next week.
That ought to do it. Thanks very much, Ray.
And we're the three best friends that anybody could have. We're the three best friends that anyone could have. We're the three best friends that anyone can have. And we'll never, ever, 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 ever leave each other. We're the best three friends that anybody could have. I mean the three best friends that anybody could have. That's right, the three best friends.
Do you guys want to play Flick Chart? Or do you have to go home and go to sleep? Josh looks excited. All right. Lord of the Rings, The Two Towers, or Rear Window?
He just knocked the excitement right out of him. Rear Window.
The Hitchcock version, right?
Yes.
Two Towers.
I'll go Rear Window, but at some point you'll have to bring that. When's that going to come up? I know we're going to try to do all three this year, right?
Yes. With the Mortal Engines coming up in, I think it's November, Peter Jackson produced, we'll probably end up at Return of the King around that time.
Somewhere so, yeah, between somewhere now and between. Then. RoboCop 87 or Glengarry Glen Ross?
Glengarry Glen Ross.
Yeah, by a mile.
Yes. L.A. Confidential or Yes Man?
I got a real soft spot for Yes Man, but it's obviously like how potential.
Scared me for a second there. Yeah.
That would have been kind of amazing.
Yes Man is a weirdly fun movie, though.
The greatest action movie of all time, or X-Men The Last Stand?
I choose Predator.
Oh, sorry.
Predator.
Sorry, what were the options?
Predator or X-Men The Last Stand?
Predator, I guess.
I as well choose Predator. I Am Legend or U-Turn?
I Am Legend.
I Am Legend.
Is U-Turn that bad?
It's not great.
Oliver Stone, right?
Right.
Sylvester Stone.
That's a different movie.
Jennifer Lopez, Sean Penn. Interesting cast. Not a particularly good movie.
There Will Be Blood, War Games.
There Will Be Blood.
Agreed.
War Games. Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, Superbad.
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 Yeah. Toy Story 3 or Hot Fuzz?
Toy Story 3.
Agreed. Yep.
The Blair Witch Project or Interview with the Vampire?
Blair Witch.
Interview with the Vampire.
Blair Witch. Spider-Man 2 or Airplane?
Spider-Man 2.
Airplane.
God, I gotta go Spider-Man 2, but I really like Airplane.
I do too, but Spider-Man 2 is awesome.
It's still a Raimi film.
Sam Raimi is a genius. Searching for Bobby Fischer, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs.
Snow White.
Snow White.
Two movies we shouldn't even be talking about. Million Dollar Baby or Signs?
Ooh, that's a good one, because I love both of those movies. Gosh, where do I go with this one? I think Signs, just because I had that experience at the theater. I actually just wrote about that on Twitter a little bit.
Really?
Yeah, and I loved that experience all up until, like, the last 5 minutes. And then, that kind of threw me out. I was expecting a whole lot more out of that. You never actually see.
See little green guys in suits.
You do, and then he swing for the fences or whatever he says. It's kind of cheesy. I'll choose whatever the other one was. Million Dollar Baby.
I'll choose that as well, but I do like Signs. The Mask, Jim Carrey, or Saw 2?
Huh, that's interesting. I'm actually going to go with Saw 2. I like The Mask. I don't love it.
I will go with Cameron Diaz's shoulder.
I will go with The Mask as well. The first three Saws, the second one I like the least. Babe or Speed?
Huh. I mean, I like Babe, but Speed. Speed has speed.
A Best Picture winner versus Speed.
Babe didn't win Best Picture.
Nominee. I'm very sorry. You're right. It's obviously Babe.
Speed.
Man. I thought for sure Babe would win, and I could be like, Speed. Oh,
we talked about Babe before you walked in, so yeah. I know that I've got my eyes fixed firmly on him right now.
You remember that Coming to America poster? I had a Speed poster slightly smaller in my room. I really love Speed, and I just kind of like Babe.
That's where I'm at.
And I've just never gone back to it after watching it the first time. The Green Mile, Galaxy Quest. That'd be a good classic sometime to make me change my mind.
Galaxy Quest?
Babe? No, Babe.
Oh, okay.
The Green Mile or Galaxy Quest is always your choice.
Green Mile.
Galaxy Quest.
One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, iRobot.
One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Agreed.
Yes. Meet the Fockers, Ghostbusters.
Which Ghostbusters?
Doesn't matter.
The first one.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, doesn't matter. Ghostbusters 2.
Wait, Ghostbusters 2? No, hang on a minute.
No. I might go meet the Fockers over at Ghostbusters 2. I don't know.
I might too, actually.
Traffic or True Romance?
Ooh. True Romance.
I agree.
I don't know, so I'll just go with you guys.
That's by far the best thing Tony Scott ever did.
Sorry. A really bad joke could have been made that was not made.
Again, no, you're cutting us off twice here, but I understand.
I mean, these are like super offensive jokes.
Okay.
The Talented Mr. Ripley or The Prophecy?
Talented Mr. Ripley.
Oh, yes. That.
Yes, I'd like to watch it again, though.
Yes.
Not The Prophecy.
No.
Armageddon. A Trip to the Moon, 1902.
A Trip to the Moon.
I'm assuming A Trip to the Moon. Armageddon turned 20.
A Trip to the Moon, I think that maybe the Méliès brothers, the very first film ever
the
made.
The Big Moon guy that that Scorsese movie.
One of the first movie, like one of the first feature films ever made.
Hugo is kind of based around this, yes?
Yeah,
am I kinda, right? That Ben Kingsley is playing that character. I'm sure that that is good.
You know what's funny, though, is they're both about trips to the moon.
That's very funny. Only one of them, though, has Steve Buscemi humping a rocket or a laser or whatever it was, or a nuclear warhead. There's a retrospective about Armageddon turning 20 this week that I am going to watch.
I did see a grudge match of Armageddon versus Deep Impact. Mm-hmm. Because they both turned 20 this year.
Deep Impact all the way.
I'm going Armageddon.
Armageddon's a piece of crap.
It kind
of
is.
It's a watchable piece of crap.
Oh, no.
But Deep Impact's forgettable.
Armageddon, man, it's the worst, like, going to the theater experience in my life. Like, food poisoning, that kind of thing, and having to go see, like, a three-hour later show because on the way to the theater, you know, issues developed. It's called Armageddon Night, like, amongst friends of mine because poor me was in a gas station for a while.
I was angry walking out of that movie, angry at how horrible it was. I was maybe more angry at the end of that movie than I was at the end of Olympus Has Fallen. In that movie, I was walking backwards, cursing as I came out of it.
Why allow yourself to get that angry?
He didn't want to close his eyes. He didn't want to fall asleep.
I value my time.
He didn't want to miss a thing.
No, you don't. You're a film critic.